The sound of waiting. Waiting for news that could change your life. In a room not your own, with people you don't know very well. These are the moments and days and weeks that women with breast cancer must face. The results of a mammogram. Waiting for the drip of a course of chemotherapy. Waiting for radiation to begin. The results of a biopsy. The outcome of a lumpectomy. Waiting. Lisa Eccles, Crystal Miller, and Anita Coleman shared these moments with us throughout 2014. Their stories.
Yesterday, Wednesday, August 20th, was my last chemo.
Today I cry tears of joy because I'm living in a moment, and I thank God that I'm still here.
On my lunch break, went to the ultrasound, came home, spoke to my doctor about my results. It's just, you know, it's a lot for one person sometimes.
From WNYC and PRI, this is Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer. Takeaway special. Three women share the ups and downs of their lives after receiving a diagnosis. Breast cancer. Fearing it and experiencing it is something common to millions of women. But the details with these three women are different. Nationally, African American women are 40% more likely to die following a breast cancer diagnosis than their white counterparts. Why? We will try to get closer to an answer. But even if we don't, we still value our time spent with these three survivors, Lisa, Crystal, and Anita. The details they shared with us show what it means to live with breast cancer.
My name is Lisa Eccles. I'm 46 years old. I live in Memphis, Tennessee. I was diagnosed with breast cancer on December the 9th, 2013.
Lisa's a hospital technician in a neonatal intensive care unit, a wife and mother of two. In her city, Memphis, black women are twice as likely to die from breast cancer as white women.
Your tumor is the size of a quarter. I'm thinking you between stage one and stage two. We can remove the tumor or we can remove the whole breast.
The language of cancer, lumps, tumors, tissue, all landmarks on a map of a woman's body.
I don't consider it a C. I consider it a T, which stands for a test for me. We all go through tests in life, and this is my test. And at the end of passing my test, I will have a story to tell somebody.
When did you get a hint that something was maybe going wrong here?
Well, I'm so good with myself, trying to be healthy. And my husband, who is a diabetic, when he was diagnosed, I got in gear as far as eating right, exercising, and going on doctor's appointments because I know that men don't like to go to see about themselves when it comes to doctors. So what we decided to do is to do it as a couple. So I will make an appointment along with him. So I already knew that in November, it was time for me to get my mammogram. My appointment was before Thanksgiving, but this particular time after going, I want to say a few days later, I got a call at work and they asked me to come back a second time. So I went and had the test done, the ultrasound done, and this when I found out on December the 9th, 2013, that I had the big C.
Well, what went through your mind there? I mean, you're the rock of the family there. You're the one who makes all the appointments. You're the one who takes care of your husband's diabetes and responsible for your two kids.
I was shocked, devastated, because I knew that in the back of my mind, I was doing all the right stuff. So, like I said, it was hard for me because at that point, I wanted to know, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? That was my biggest concern. Where did I go wrong at? Those thoughts come in your mind when you right. first hear it, because you're trying to figure out the puzzle. But after settling down, I realized that it wasn't for me to figure out.
Hmm. So how did you tell your husband? How did you tell your kids? I mean, what's that like?
As soon as I walked out of the doctor's office, I told my husband what they had said. And he took it very well, because I guess he didn't want me to see him upset. And as far as my children, I didn't tell them until the biopsy came back. I told my husband to just act as normal and wait on the results before we set the children down to tell them. And the biggest part for me, and the hardest part for me, was telling my daughter, who lives in Nashville, and she just had left from being at home for Thanksgiving. She wanted to come home, and I said, no, I'm okay, and I'm going to be okay. But telling my son here, who's still living at home, his biggest thing was, Mom, are you in any pain? And I said, no. And from there, he said, are you going to lose your hair? And I said, I'm going to be as bald as you are.
So bald on top, but you had some decisions to make, right?
I did. I had a lot of decisions to make. And when you've been handed the sea, it's like your life moves really fast. I've decided that I was going to have a bilateral mastectomy, which is removing both breasts and doing reconstruction. That is ahead of me, and I'm ready to go forward with it.
My name is Crystal Miller. My age is 28. I was diagnosed December 23rd, 2013, and I am a cancer survivor, even while being treated.
Crystal works in healthcare. She's a nurse here in New York City, and she detected a lump in her own breast before she ever got a mammogram.
I'm stage one. I'm actually triple positive. Some people are triple negative. I'm triple positive. 1 centimeter. I've had a lumpectomy. And also an additional thing is I've had my chemo before surgery. A lot of people have it after surgery. In my given case, it was better for me to have it before surgery. Something I struggled with, mind you, in the beginning.
These are decisions that come along with breast cancer. Decisions shared openly in our conversations that covered a lot of things. But these women also wanted to say in the course of our months together that it's okay to talk about all of this stuff.
This is an aspect of my life. It doesn't overshadow what's going on currently in other parts of my life. It doesn't overshadow anything that I accomplished already or that I'm going to accomplish. And, you know, that's important to me. I like it that way. It hasn't taken over everything.
When you first were diagnosed, what were your thoughts?
You know, I was shocked because, you know, I don't have this in my family. I work in cancer and my patients tend to be older. And, you know, I just didn't see this coming. Obviously, you know, when I felt the lump, I had a gut feeling, but I was just shocked and I didn't know how it was going to affect my life or my future. And, you know, it was scary.
And part of that is because you're so young.
Right. And, you know, I didn't know what stage I was. And, you know, I haven't done a lot of things that I want to do. You know, I haven't been married. I haven't had a child. And it was scary.
Being in a medical environment, how do you avoid going down the rabbit hole of, oh, there's this treatment, there's this treatment, there's this research, there's this is a journal article to read, there's this new thing, there's this new. How do you keep from doing that?
I think in the beginning, I tried to look up stuff, and when something, the doctor said something, I'd run home and like Google it. What's tamoxifen? What's this? And I think it kind of hurt you a little bit. I am all for people supporting each other and learning about different, you know, experiences. And but everything that happens to somebody else doesn't mean it's going to happen to you. So for now, I tend, and I say now because maybe in the future as I continue to get treated, maybe I'll feel differently. But for now, I'm not really looking at things online. I have a rapport with my medical team, my breast oncologist and my breast surgeon. And, you know, I trust that they will bring me information as it comes up and that they will, if I need some type of data or supportive information, that they will be able to provide it. You know, I become obsessed when I'm looking online and Googling, and I don't want to get the wrong information and not have somebody there who's, you know, this is their area. and not be able to interpret it with me and, you know, explain it to me.
Well, it sounds also like you've made a real conscious decision. There's data, mm-hmm. and then there's Crystal's life.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
and Crystal's life is real, and data is kind of sitting there on the page.
Right, right.
How'd you come to that?
I think any significant event, especially breast cancer, it makes you learn about yourself. And now I know for sure that I'm controlling. This is something that I'm not in control of. So now what? You know, how do you proceed? I just think I've learned so much about myself. Something's good, something's bad, and I'm trying to correct it. And I try to do the best for what works for me. And that might not work for the next person, but I do what works best for me and what keeps me positive and on the right track.
So here's the hard stuff.
Uh-huh. I'm ready.
you're 28, right?
Yeah. I was 27 when diagnosed.
Right. 2 days before Christmas. Merry
yeah.
Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, dating in your late 20s often is not fun. You know?
Right.
But it must be particularly challenging
yeah.
for you. I mean, just what's the...
How does that go?
How does that work?
I don't know. I have to figure it out. I haven't really dated. I just, you know, it's interesting. In the beginning, it feels like it's going to be a burden on somebody. I'm like, who's going to want to deal with this, you know? And because I think people hear about it, but I don't think they understand what it totally means.
Right.
You know, the nitty gritty. And I think when it comes to that, I'm just going to have to learn, like trial and error. You know, when's the best time to bring it up? This is something I'm going through. You know, I have to take tamoxifen, which it's going to be for 5 years, 5 to 10 years. There are potential side effects of that. And having to, like, explain that to them, it's a little scary. You know, I don't know how they're going to react. Or am I going to be rejected? I don't know.
Let me just say, anybody who rejects you for tamoxifen is a loser, okay?
Yeah, I mean, and even like my fertility, you know, I wasn't with somebody when I had to make fertility decisions in the beginning. And it happened so quickly because you have to make it before treatment. And, you know, I opted not to do fertility treatment. I wanted to get started right away. If it has affected my fertility, you know, making sure that the person that I'm going to marry or be with, like, understands that, you know what I mean? That, you know, there's a potential that you might not be able to have. I might not be able to child the ideal way or the conventional way. So something I think about, in the beginning, it bothered me. You know, that was one of the most upsetting things, I think. Actually, before all of this, I was one of those people, like the typical single New Yorker. I was like, maybe at 35, 36, maybe I'll think about it. I didn't even know if I wanted kids, to be honest. I didn't think that like was going to complete me. I wanted to be married, though. You know, I wanted to be married. And I was like, that would be my family. If a kid happens, it happens. And it's funny because when this happened, it changed. I'm like, wait, I want a kid. Like, I don't want this decision being made for me. You know, I want to make the decision. And but I started to stay positive, and I think it will happen if I want it to happen.
My name is Anita Coleman. I am 54 years old. I live in Los Angeles, California, and I was diagnosed on February 21st, 2014. This is my second diagnosis for breast cancer.
Anita is our veteran. She knows the jargon, she knows the waiting, and the fear.
Stage 2 breast cancer. I had two types of tumors, one positive receptor, one negative. The first time, out of 16 lymph nodes, 14 of them were cancerous. This time, I believe out of 16 lymph nodes, only 2 of them were cancerous.
Sitting with Anita, it was like we were at her kitchen table. She had lots to say. And again, she believes silence about cancer doesn't help anything.
Because of the aggressiveness of my first diagnosis, I had to go 10 years before I was in remission. In 2011, I made my 10 years, and I was like, okay. But they had always told me that it could be dormant. And in February 2014, I went for my annual mammogram, and my primary care physician called me and he said, your mammogram looks suspicious. We want you to go to ultrasound. He said, it looks like, you know, you have cancer again. And I went for the ultrasound, and they did see 2 lumps. And my doctor scheduled me for a core-guided biopsy. I went for that, and his assistant called and said, the doctor wants to see you in his office. And I was actually coming out of a store because we were preparing for the party that I was giving that's going to say either I didn't have cancer again or I did. And I pulled over to the side and he told me. And it was like, okay, I was upset for a minute, but 99% of you says the test is going to be negative. But there's that 1% that said, just in case, you better get ready. And at that point, I knew I had to get ready. So I did some crying there, went home, did some more crying, called a couple of my friends and family, let them do their crying. I said, okay, that's enough. That's it. Let's move on with this.
Is there any decision that you made the first time around that you wish you'd made now?
The first time around, I had asked them if I could have a double mastectomy, and they talked to me because at that time I was engaged, and they said, I'm, you know, for relationships and for appearance. Now, at this age and what I'm thinking about appearance, which doesn't mean as much to me now as it did then, and don't get me wrong, I always keep myself up, but if I had known then, I probably would have had the double mastectomy, but I can't just keep going back to what I should have done, because I could have had the double mastectomy and they still could have diagnosed me with another cancer. So I can't beat myself up about that.
No. How do you feel about the statistics on the outcomes for African-American women and the really scary probabilities compared with other populations?
When you're going through a health challenge like this, one of the key factors is to remain stress-free, to be in a safe environment, quiet environment, and I have been fortunate that I don't have to worry about my medical bills because I had retired once, and so I have full medical coverage. So many African-American women, they don't have the coverage that they need. And then some of them, I've met people. I know women who had cancer and chose not to have the treatment because they had to go to work to support their family. My whole thing is you don't have to have a lot of money to make it. There's a lot of people and a lot of groups out there that will help, but pride sometimes keeps people from asking for help. Our exercise, our health, our eating habits, we have to change those. And people don't like to change, but a lot of people going through cancer don't realize they have to exercise. With the education about the disease and the education about the recovery process, we have to be more proactive. And that's where African-American women have not been proactive because they're so busy taking care of their families. A lot has to change.
We chose Lisa Eccles, Crystal Miller, and Anita Coleman to share their stories of what it means to fight a life-threatening disease, partly because their moments of fear and relief, their day-to-day routines of treatment and appointments and medication associated with breast cancer are common to so many women. But why do the numbers say that the outcomes for African-American women are so different, much worse than for whites and others? For the science behind the statistics, we turn to Dr. Nancy Lynn Keating, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and a primary care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Definitely we do know that African-American women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancers that have more aggressive features. But there's some concern that that only explains a certain portion of the differences, because African-American women often are diagnosed with tumors with similar features to white women. So I think that it probably explains some of the differences, but definitely not all of the differences.
What's a physiological reason for a tumor to be more aggressive in an African-American woman? And then let's look at some of the other factors.
Right. So African-American women are more likely to have tumors that are called triple negative tumors. So these are tumors that have estrogen and progestin receptor negative and also are negative for another tumor marker called HER2. And we do know that these tumors are more aggressive biologically. They're more difficult to treat, and women with these tumors do worse. But still, these only account for a minority of tumors that African-American women get.
And in our encounters and being on a journey with our three women friends, you can tell certain features about their lives, which I'm wondering, again, I'm just speculating, might contribute to some of the outcomes in this statistic, in the sense that we've met people who are real caregivers, who, you know, think of everyone else before themselves, who maybe don't report their own symptoms as rapidly as others. Are we finding that as as a feature of the population of African American women generally?
I think that's right. I think regardless of what you look at, whether it's breast cancer or other conditions, there's many, many conditions for which African American individuals do more poorly than white Americans. And I think the reasons for this are vast and encompass all different areas. You know, some of them are that women who are minorities are less likely to evaluate an abnormality in their breast. They take longer to get to the doctor. There's some evidence that screening may be a little bit less. In some settings, that has caught up, but in other settings, it does seem like African-American women may be less likely to get screened. They may be less likely to have a usual doctor who's the one that recommends screening for them. Even if they get screened, if there's an abnormality, it may take longer for them to get that evaluated for numerous reasons we can come back to. There's evidence that once diagnosed, African-American women are diagnosed with more advanced tumors, higher stage, which is more difficult to treat and more difficult to cure than the earlier tumors. And there's evidence that African-American women are less likely to get treatment that's recommended, such as definitive surgery. They're more likely to have delays in getting treatment, and they also seem to be a little less likely to complete a recommended course of therapy. And, you know, that's sort of the treatment issues. They also tend to see providers who are different. African-American women tend to get cared for by a minority of hospitals and doctors who are taking care of patients overall. And sometimes they're getting cared for at hospitals and by doctors who are under-resourced because they're safety net providers who don't have the same kind of resources as other providers. And then, you know, factoring in on top of all of this and overlaying on top of all of this are the social and ecological issues. And a lot of this just factors in with American society, which is that African-American women are more likely to live in areas of poverty. Along with that comes all kinds of issues. They're more likely to have jobs for which it's more difficult to get away from work and less likely that they have insurance through their job. If they have insurance, they're more likely to be underinsured, meaning they either have insurance through Medicaid, which does not reimburse as well as other providers, and so that can factor in on who will see them. They may also be more likely to have health insurance plans with high deductibles, so higher out-of-pocket costs to get to the doctor. Then on top of that, you know, they might have jobs where they can't easily get off of work, or they might have childcare and difficulty getting childcare or getting transportation to the doctor, which, I mean, imagine if you need radiation therapy and it takes 5 weeks of daily treatments and you don't have anyone to take care of your children, or you can't leave your job and know that your job will be there for you when you get back. And on top of all of this, there's also some concern that Black women may be less likely to understand what's going on or understand their tumors. There may be communication issues. There may be issues of trust in their doctors due to sort of prior history of African Americans in American healthcare. And there's also a hypothesis that poverty is associated with chronic stress, which may also inhibit the body's ability to fight itself and to fight off diseases itself. So lots and lots of issues.
Well, we can see the childcare problems possibly explaining why African American women would not complete a course of treatment. And a lot of the factors that you described earlier are caused by delay. What do you think causes the delay? What is it that causes an African-American woman to wait before going to the doctor? Is it process things, procedural things, that the wheels of their own healthcare system move more slowly? Or are they actually hesitant to get treatment at all?
I think it's a combination of those things. I will tell you that, you know, some efforts to try to improve seeking care for women who notice a problem have focused on really trying to improve understanding of breast health and get women talking about their own health and, you know, reaching out through churches and through community organizations to really help people understand what it means to take care of yourself, how to look after yourself, how to think about and get help when you need it. And I think that those interventions are very promising. But there's just so much interplay between all of these factors. And, you know, I think so far we really have a long way to go.
Well, certainly the women that we've met really want to talk about their experience. And the responses that we've gotten indicate a kind of hunger out there to get this conversation going. Do you think it's already started or that much more needs to be done?
I think it has started, but I also agree that much more needs to be done. And I think that definitely raising awareness of breast health and breast cancer in minority communities is really important. But that's not going to solve the problem. You know, I think that there's also issues even at the provider level of when someone comes in with a problem, how long does it take to evaluate that and, you know, get from breast problem to diagnosis? And then once the diagnosis happens, then it's a matter of getting to treatment. And then once treatment happens, it's a matter of completing treatment. And I think at each of these steps of the way, there are lots of things factoring in that are making it more challenging. And so we really do need to be hitting at all these different levels.
Dr. Nancy Lynn Keating is a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and a primary care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
You keep living, you're going to get a little pouch, you're going to get some love handles, but you still are the same person. You're still that beautiful being.
That's the voice of Anita Coleman, entering in her audio diary, her experience on July 31st, 2014.
To find yourself knowing that you are beautiful regardless to what you look like. I want to be considered and remembered by the person I am, not how I look.
And here's Lisa Eccles on July 7th.
I had both breasts removed. With that, there is no natural breast tissue. So it has affected my body. But the thing is, it has not affected me and how I live from this point on.
This is Crystal Miller on July 29th.
You know, I have a scar on my face from a car accident that I was in. And, you know, I used to be, like, so insecure about the scar. As I got older, like, when I would talk about it, people would be like, what scar? They hadn't, you know, hadn't noticed it. And that's when I knew, like, it's all about how you feel about yourself. And a lot of people, they don't pay attention to those type of things. They don't, those aren't the things that they notice about you first. So I feel like if I feel sexy, if I feel beautiful, other people usually feel that way about you.
Crystal and Lisa are finding a new relationship with their own bodies, and the people around these women also have some learning to do. For instance, it's quite a task for Anita Coleman to keep her grandchildren from knowing too much about what's going on with her right now. Here's Anita on July 4th.
They know that I'm just sick. That's how they see it. Basically, on my down days, they don't come around me because, number one, my patience level is short and the little bickering back and forth. I can't take it. But I really don't want them to see me barely moving some days because children, they have lasting impressions. And the impression that I don't want them to see is when I can't barely walk, the days that it's hard to walk, or the days where I just am tired.
On July 17th, Lisa Eccles brought her 16-year-old son along for her treatment.
He got a chance to see what I really go through when I go for my treatment. We was able to sit down and really talk and for me to find out what was going on in his life and for him to see the lifestyle that I'm going through now.
For these women, there's a lot of watching and feeling and listening to their own bodies, looking into the mirror, the first line of defense now. Crystal Miller on July 11th.
Tonight I was waiting in the car for a friend and I was just like feeling on my neck and I felt a lump. And I don't know if it's a lymph node or if it's just a bump. I'm definitely going to try to email my doctor and tell the radiation oncologist or nurse on Monday. I am hoping that this is nothing and, you know, it's just something normal.
There's no amount of vigilance alone that can keep cancer from returning or spreading, just like there's nothing that can keep the experience from spreading into all parts of life, like trying to make ends meet. Here's Lisa Eccles, August 15th.
It has been stressful to a certain extent because my husband having to cover majority of all the bills, so it has been pressure, but we don't have a whole lot of big bills because both our cars are paid off, and I thank God for that. But it's just the little bitty things that we try to keep up with, and some of them we can keep up with, and some of them we can't, and we have to have food or have light. So we usually just pay those, and the ones that we can't pay,
we just call them and say, well, we can't make a payment this month. We'll double up next month.
Crystal Miller, July 8th.
I definitely spent a lot of money. I kind of tried not to worry about it while I was getting treated because I knew it was in my account and I knew I had a little room and I didn't want to stress about things unnecessarily. But in the beginning, when I was on chemotherapy, especially like the first month, I took a lot of cabs to work and to treatment. And I was spending maybe about $25 to go to work and then about $40 to go home every day. So, you know, that adds up. My family had to pay a lot too because they came every 3 weeks to see me by train and by car. And that's costly too. When they stay here having to get food and like eat out and all those things.
And here's Anita Coleman on August 17th.
This time around, I was laid off around the same time I was diagnosed, but I had relocated. My living expenses were less. And also, since I had knew I was going to be laid off, I cut out some of the extra things. And staying off from work, you just don't get to do a lot of the extra things, but it's okay because I have time to go on walks, go to the beach, just sit around and take in the simple things that I don't have a chance to take in when I'm working.
For 6 months, Lisa Eccles, Crystal Miller, and Anita Coleman let us follow their ups and downs in the weeks and months following their breast cancer diagnoses. But the important people in their lives are in there for the long haul, and we got to meet some of them. People who were there before our series and who will be there afterwards. Friends and family.
Hi, my name is Demetrius Johnson. I am the daughter to Lisa Eccles. And I just wanted to give you all an insight on how women that have breast cancer, what the children and the young women feel, you know, knowing that their mother has breast cancer.
For Demetrius Johnson, it's learning that your rock of a mom is actually vulnerable.
The automatic thing that I thought was, I'm about to lose my mother. And being a young woman whose mother is your best friend, not only just your best friend, but she wears so many hats. You can go to her for labs. You can go to her for serious talks. You can go to her for business. And you can go to her just for the comfort of being around her, just to feel, you know, that love. To know that that could be snatched away from me. It was very, very hurtful.
Demetrius discovered that helping a cancer survivor means stepping up and being the rock mom taught you to be.
The next time that I felt any pain was getting a photograph sent to my phone of my mother, and she had no hair. And that absolutely hurt because my mother had long, thick, charcoal hair. I've never known my mother's hair to be short, ever. So for her not to have any, it took a toll on me. And I told her, since you don't have any hair, do you want me to cut my hair off? And she said, no, I'm fine. If that's something that you want to do, then do it. But you don't have to. I'm fine. And I realized Bob is beautiful, and she's beautiful, and she's embraced it. She's smiling. So I have to embrace it and smile. My mother is a fighter, and we were going to fight this battle together.
Can you imagine on a hot night coming up here?
Anita Coleman introduced us to one of her best friends, Doris Johnson.
See the bridge?
What bridge is that?
The one that carries you from Brooklyn to someplace. No. But I've been there, you know. I've been on this last journey with her every step of it. From the moment that she found out to where we are right now.
We met Doris when Anita and her friend made the journey together to New York City. Tough Anita, we learned, was afraid to fly, while Doris shared that she's afraid she won't have enough strength for her friend Anita.
I consider myself blessed to be in her presence, because to see a person go through this and you're like, oh, I don't know if I had that strength too, because it's not easy. It's just not easy. And before, I didn't realize, you know, and it's when they say, oh, I got cancer treatment, I'm doing this, what is that? But after going through it, I'm like, okay, there's a whole lot of stuff involved.
Doris says she's learned a lot from Anita's sharing. It's made her less afraid of what could eventually be her story, and it's made her a more compassionate caregiver to her friend.
That's a good thing, because it's a positive story. It's her story, and people will see that they can also arrive at the other side. If you're willing to fight for your life, you get there. And some, you know, they need to hear that. You just need to hear good things. At least I do. And I've watched her at her worst, and we've crawled through it together, and then she's ready to go. Okay, let's go.
Okay, let's go. Well, not everyone we met was so willing. Crystal Miller introduced us to her father, Keith, who told us he was stopped cold when he learned his only daughter had breast cancer. Keith is a minister, talks regularly with God, he told us, and as we learned, had to do a lot of talking this year.
2 days before Christmas, it was very heartbreaking. And you want to be there to support your child. And you try not to show any weakness because you want to be strong. But when you have those moments and you're alone, the tears do flow, you know.
Now, is that weakness, Crystal?
No.
The tears flowing?
No, I think it's human. I think it's love, that he cares so much about me that he didn't want to see me have to go through this. So I don't see it as a weakness at all.
And what did you make of her wanting to share this whole story with the entire universe here?
You know, being a pastor, I believe that when we experience things in life, that there's a big picture. Even though we're knocked down, sometimes we do get up. And because we're able to get up, we're able to help those who have faced similar situations. And sometimes that can be our calling in life, to be able to share our experiences with others so others may be able to see their way through a situation.
So the preacher's daughter becomes a preacher. That's what this is about here.
Yeah, I think it's great to be able to share your testimony. And I think it was great to actually do it while I was going through, as well as just not the end, because, you know, it's easy after everything's said and done to be like, yeah, I did it, you could do it too, da, 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 da. But to actually see somebody going through and saying, I'm doing it, and showing them that it can be done, I think that was important. A lot of times we go through life and we think everything's about us, and really it's not. You know, it's about other people, helping other people. And I think I've learned that.
Yes.
And what's the status medically, without getting into too many details?
I'm cancer-free, and I'm almost finished with treatment. I have 2 more infusions to go, and I will be done December 19th. So I'm very happy. Very happy to say I'm cancer-free.
Now, are you happy? Are you lucky? Are you blessed?
Blessed. Yeah, I definitely don't believe in luck. I saw this day. Sometimes it was difficult to see, but I saw this day coming where I was going to be cancer-free, and I knew it would I believed it would happen. Hmm.
So, you know, cancer's everybody's, you know, top 10 fear.
Yes.
Right, Keith?
Right.
But a parent's number one fear is what?
Oh, boy. No one wants to see their child suffering. And I think there's a fear that you may lose your child. Just those thoughts when you love your family, those thoughts that go through your mind, you know, even being a pastor, you know, you're still human. And it's one of those things where you have to have faith in believing and trusting that God will bring you through. And I've always raised my children to believe that whatever they face or whatever they go through, they can overcome it.
Mm-hmm. What did you think when he started to join our audio diary project?
Well, when I heard it, I didn't hear it prior to it airing, and it was very emotional for me because, you know, that's my father, and I don't see him cry or anything like that. He's the head of the household and strong and stuff like that. So it was difficult for me to hear him going through that because, you know, I didn't miss a night of sleep during this. I just didn't realize that he was going through that hard of a time. And I do think it was more difficult for my parents to watch me and stuff like that. And I was far away. You know, they weren't here with me every second. But I will say, like, the day that I was diagnosed, I remember going downstairs to talk to you, just like me and you, and you said, now is the time to put your faith to work. So I think he gave me really good words of wisdom and how to be grateful, you know, because it could be worse. I remember him saying that too. So I think the things that he told me in the beginning, the day of my diagnosis, is really what got me through my treatment, my perspective on things. And it really got me through.
Thank you.
Cancer can either beat you or you beat it. I prefer the latter.
Anita Coleman, November 12th, 2014. Our six-month series, Under Her Skin, came to an end at the end of the year. And for Anita Coleman, December began with some good news.
It's December 3rd, 2014. This is the last day of radiation. I am truly thankful. I am truly blessed. I thank my medical team. They are extraordinary.
On December 10th, Anita underwent an elective surgery to remove her ovaries after testing positive for the BRCA gene, which puts her at a higher risk for ovarian cancer as well as breast cancer. But Anita told us she saw that surgery as one of her last hurdles.
My current health challenge and the experiences that have accompanied it have provided me with the greater appreciation of life. What you see, the physical me you see when the hair was gone, the nails turned black, the swelling, that's not me. I am inside of me.
I still have one more surgery to have, and that surgery is a hysterectomy.
By the close of our series, Lisa Eccles in Memphis had a decision to make. Her doctors told her she was looking good, but after her year of treatments, she wasn't going to take any chances.
That is something that I wanted to do, to be on the safe side. That was my plan in the beginning, so I will be getting that done right after the holidays.
Besides her hysterectomy, Lisa has had six rounds of chemotherapy, a bilateral mastectomy, Herceptin treatment, reconstruction, and implants. And she now takes medication that she will remain on for years.
To be able to step out of my comfort zone and do something that I never had to do in my life, you know, I really, really like this experience. To be able to talk to people and motivate people to keep pushing on and don't give up and just know that you're not in this by yourself.
That's Lisa talking about the experience of telling her story to us, something she never thought she would do.
That there are thousands and thousands of women that go through this each and every day. And I'm so glad to be able to help other women of color and to let them know that it's going to be okay and that there is hope. Even when you are about to give up, don't.
Probably the most cheerful of our three new friends is young Crystal. Her year finished with a bright anticipation of many more years ahead.
I feel like I can see the other side, you know. The storm's over and I can see the rainbow starting to form. I think that in itself is like a beautiful thing. I think it's the most important part of the story, the recovery.
This is Crystal Miller, 1 year after her diagnosis.
To me, this wasn't about breast cancer in itself. It was about me facing something that was out of my hands, that some things I didn't have control over, about finding my relationship with God. And I live by myself and live alone. So some things I don't talk about, or I really don't communicate it or write it down and just get it out there. And I think that helped with this to really document what I was feeling at times and what I was going through. And I think it probably may have surprised people who were closer to me to know what I was feeling at times and what I was going through. I definitely had my moments, and I think that's okay. I think it was good to show that.
These diaries of three women making their way through the experience of breast cancer have been heard by millions online and on the air. A community of people sharing stories who have joined our Facebook group and contacted each other directly. Here's Anita Coleman speaking back on November 12th about her new community and these new friends.
It is amazing that the other two young ladies going through this journey and being interviewed, the strength that they have. And not only their strength, their courage. I admire them both. I just hope it will help someone else. And by answering questions and talking to whoever wants to talk about it, just maybe one person will say, I'll go get that mammogram when I need it. Or instead of saying, I feel so sorry for myself, I have cancer, that they will say, I can beat this, and I will.
Over the months of our series, these women who we met in a world of doctor's offices, biopsies and medication, wigs, chemo and hair loss, tears and worry, gradually transcended their circumstances and became a part of each other's lives. Lisa, Anita, and Crystal had grown to rely on each other, By the time we got them together for the very first time in December of 2014, we were introducing three women who were already old friends.
You know, it signifies a lot. And just like the new year coming up, I really didn't want to bring this into the new year. I just want to, like, make the next year the best year of my life. It's really a reflection on how far I've come and that I've made it. You know, I got through it. And I know this probably won't be the only thing in my life. Things happen. But it's going to be a reminder that I can, you know, I am a conqueror. I can get through anything.
And you got your pals.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Anita, how about you?
I'm looking forward, first of all, not to have any doctor's appointments. I have one more on Tuesday. It's a blessing. Every day is a blessing for me because this is my second time around. So I just am thankful. I'm coming up on a year in February for my diagnosis, and I'm thankful for all the support system I have, my family, and just knowing that I am empowered to get through anything. It's just a feeling that it frees you.
You're nodding, Lisa.
I am. My year from diagnosis has passed. Mine was December the 9th. And when it came to that, you know, it was like I could exhale. And just at this point, I can enjoy life and be so grateful. You know, some people take life for granted. But when you have went through a storm, you cherish every moment, every day, every bite of food that you can eat that you couldn't probably eat when you was going through chemo, and every strength that God has given to you that you didn't have when you was going through. It's just the little bitty things to me that counts.
So anything about your stories that you didn't want to share that was really off limits to the community of Under Her Skin, Lisa?
No, I shared everything. I want people to really know, and when they hear my voice, to know what I've been through. You know, I don't want to hold anything back, because if you hold something back, then somebody might need that information. So I don't want to hold back anything, and I didn't hold anything back.
Anita?
I haven't held anything back, because what cancer did for me is it let me be a little bit freer in expression. Because Crystal and Lisa, I know you can emphasize with me, like when you go to the doctor and all these different doctors, you're open, you know. You can't say, oh no, don't look here, don't look there. And so what I've done is, if a lady asks me, well, how does the burns look, you know, hey, let's step over here, you can see. Why hold back? Because what you can show somebody or tell somebody, it eases their pain, because people are apprehensive. And when I was going through radiation in my last couple of days, when the burning was really bad, my doctor shielded me. She didn't want a new patient to see me. She said, because if the lady saw how much pain I was in and how I was walking, and I said, but no, let her see. I mean, you know, who in fall goes to the doctor in a tube top dress? Because I couldn't wear a bra and the pain was excruciating. But when she said, I don't want her to see what you're going through because it'll keep her from wanting to do it, I said, no, if she sees it, she can embrace it. Because fear, we're our own worst enemies. And if you're fearful of something, but you see somebody else who's gone through it, it helps you get through it.
Yeah.
Crystal, I'm sensing you maybe learned a little more about vulnerability this year.
Yeah, and, you know, I was pretty open during the whole thing. But something I probably did keep back was dating. I really didn't speak about that, but I am dating somebody. And he's been around since the beginning, but not until recently where we really started dating and stuff like that. And I think now it's important for me to share, because that was some of maybe that, as far as vulnerability, I didn't really want to be that vulnerable, because there's room for rejection or somebody not wanting to go through this with you and stuff like that. And, you know, having to show scars and those type of things. I'm on a drug that can make you feel like you're in menopause and all those things. And, you know, I just want to share it now, because I think it's important for other women of all ages to know that this doesn't have to be something that hinders that. And there are people who will understand and are willing to, like, work through things with you. So that's something I didn't share.
So Anita and Lisa, it sounds like this guy maybe passed a test over the last
year. I think
so. Yes, as I say, go Crystal, go Crystal. Because it takes this is my opinion. It's an honor. Whoever I end up with, it's an honor for them to be with me. Because you have to see yourself in that light. So, Crystal, you are worthy. Know that whoever you pick, it's not they picked you. You picked them. And it's an honor because, to me, our wounds are like pins that, you know, I'm not saying we're soldiers in a war. But, you know, if you get a Medal of Valor, whatever, your scars, they're your medals. You know, it's a tribute to what you went through and how you persevered to be here. So, you know, he's blessed. He's lucky. Tell him he doesn't want me to come from California anymore.
Thank you.
Now we really put the pressure on. What a way to end the year. Well, ladies, it's been great being with you this year, and I really admire your candor and, you know, your willingness to share and being at the center of this great community.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for, like, providing us with the platform.
Yes.
And also bringing attention to breast cancers and minorities.
Yes.
And the disparities amongst those, you know, different groups and stuff like that. It's talked about all the time in my field, but I don't think a lot of people, even other breast cancer survivors that I share certain statistics with, you know, they're not aware of it. So I want to, you know, I'm very grateful for providing the platform for us to speak and get our stories out there.
You guys have been great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And there they go, imagining each other's future fearlessly and knowing that somebody has their back. That's the lesson of our series. Winning against cancer is not erasing death. It is learning to live more deeply. Lisa Eccles tells everyone it's easier when you think we instead of I. Here's Lisa's message on December 3rd.
We can do it. We can beat this. You can beat this. And you're gonna beat this. Just fight on, sister. Fight on.
Thanks for listening to this Takeaway Hour, Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer, from WNYC and Public Radio International. We want to leave you now with something we discovered online over these past 6 months in trying to learn everything we could about breast cancer. We were always stumbling onto lots of little communities of people sharing their experiences, information, stories, and poems. Here's an anonymous poem we found from a site called Choose Hope. It's called What Cancer Cannot Do. Cancer is so limited. It cannot cripple love. It cannot shatter hope. It cannot corrode faith. It cannot eat away peace. It cannot destroy confidence. It cannot kill friendship. It cannot shut out memories. It cannot silence courage. It cannot reduce eternal life. It cannot quench the spirit. It's still not too late to catch up on the experiences of Crystal Miller, Lisa Eccles, and Anita Coleman. They're still posting their details. The story goes on. Just visit us at thetakeaway.org. On the right-hand side of the page, you'll find links to our series where you can hear all of the audio diaries. And if you want to take part in the conversation, join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and type in Under Her Skin. There you will find men and women, breast cancer patients, survivors, friends and family members, all asking questions and offering advice for surviving breast cancer. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. LegalZoom, for over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.